Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
I'm Gabriel Gatehouse, and from BBC Radio 4, this is Series 2 of The Coming Storm. There's a divide in American politics between those who think democracy is in peril and those who think it's already been subverted, hollowed out from the inside. As America prepares to elect its next president, we go through the looking glass into a world where nothing is as it seems and the institutions of the state are a facade. Listen wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. We're coming to you live from London. I'm James Menendez. In just a moment, we'll have the latest on the conflict between Israel and Hezbollah in Lebanon. The militant group have fired a missile at Tel Aviv for the first time. Also in the programme, why are so many children, particularly in Asia, now short-sighted? But we are going to start once again in the Middle East and Israel's ongoing bombardment of southern Lebanon. Attacks directed at the Iran-backed militant group Hezbollah after nearly a year of fighting across Israel's northern border. Hundreds of people in Lebanon have been killed in this latest escalation. Thousands more have had to flee their homes. We'll have more on that in just a moment. But we are going to start in Israel because early today, Hezbollah stepped up its response to the attacks by firing a ballistic missile towards Tel Aviv, intercepted by one of Israel's air defence systems. These residents of the city gave their reaction to the attack.
The situation is difficult. We feel pressure, tension. It doesn't feel good. It's been going on for a long time. And this morning, we were reminded of how it feels up in the north or down south, which is very, very, very unpleasant.
It was a little stressful this morning in the first 2 minutes. But after that, I saw that nothing was happening. The world wasn't falling apart. Everything continued as usual. I went back to my routine.
Well, let's talk to the BBC's Daniel De Simone, who joins us now from Jerusalem. And Daniel, Hezbollah hasn't fired a missile at Tel Aviv before, is that right?
That's correct. This was the first time they've done it. Tel Aviv has been targeted by other groups and others in the past, but this is the first time that Hezbollah has ever fired a missile at Tel Aviv. So I think it's significant in that sense. It hasn't happened before, and they've chosen today to do that.
And what was the target of this missile?
Well, according to Hezbollah, they were targeting the headquarters of Mossad, the Israeli spy agency, and Hezbollah said they were being targeted because they're saying that Mossad was responsible for the pager and walkie-talkie explosions in Lebanon last week. Obviously, a lot of other people attribute that to Mossad as well. Israel says that the missile itself wasn't that precise, despite the Hezbollah claiming that was the target. It was actually heading elsewhere towards a residential building. And they say in reality, Hezbollah knows it's not going to be that precise and that it's very reckless when it fires a missile like this at a very built-up area like Tel Aviv.
And do we know anything about what sort of weapon it was? I mean, is it something that could have caused a lot of damage if it had landed?
Yeah, it could have caused them. I think the general assessment is that a missile like this, were it to strike, would be capable of destroying a building or significantly damaging a building. It was one missile. I think it's widely assessed that Hezbollah has an arsenal of anything between 100,000, 150,000 rockets, missiles, other weapons. So they do, and despite, and that was before this week, obviously there's Israel saying that they've destroyed a large number of weapons and other things that are possessed by Hezbollah in the last week. But I think firing one missile, they could have fired more. I think there's an element of a message from Hezbollah in this, showing that they're still capable of firing missiles and that they have an intent to strike, that they would potentially have an intent to strike Tel Aviv.
And Daniel, I mean, in the past half hour, the White House in Washington has described the missile firing at Tel Aviv deeply concerning with the words they used. I mean, how's it playing in Israel?
I think there is a concern. The stated goal of the Israeli military operation in the north is to return home 60,000 Israelis who've been displaced in the north of the country by rocket fire from Hezbollah over the past year. And so all of this activity we're seeing, all of these airstrikes, which have killed hundreds in Lebanon, is designed to achieve that. And Hezbollah is still firing rockets. It's still causing disruption to people in northern Israel. And now what Hezbollah is doing with this missile today, is sort of showing, well, we're still capable of doing this. We can actually go further south, and we can even aim at Tel Aviv. So I think there's an element of Hezbollah showing, as they've said publicly, we're still going to carry on and we're not going to stop. So I think there's a concern here about that, because the goal that's been fixed by the Israeli government for itself clearly hasn't been met yet, because Hezbollah's still firing. So I think there'll be concern. There's concern here amongst some about the whole escalation of the conflict in the north of the country and where that could end up. Other people who want to see Hezbollah taken out will also feel perhaps that hasn't happened yet, and therefore will want to see further action.
Daniel, thank you very much indeed. The BBC's Daniel De Simone, who was speaking to us from Jerusalem. Let's hear from Lebanon now, because the last few days of Israel's bombardment, particularly of southern Lebanon, has meant that tens of thousands of people have had to flee their homes. Some have been housed in temporary displacement centres. We'll hear a bit more about those in just a moment. Others, though, are relying on the kindness of friends, relatives and strangers. Among those offering help is Fadi. He lives in a town called Hamana, about 20 miles east of Beirut. He told NewsHour's James Kumarasamy how many people had come there in the past couple of days.
In our area, it's completely like around 3,000-4,000.
How many people do you have living with you at the moment?
In this moment, I have 28 persons, 16 adults with my kids, all in total 28. We have 3 bedrooms. Another flat, it's also 3 bedroom. We are living in 2 flat.
And where are they coming from?
Direct in the border. But before they come, our neighbor, she knows someone in the Lebanese army. She take his ID and she check with the Lebanese army if they have anyone fighting with Hezbollah, because she didn't accept people, family for people they are fighting with Hezbollah.
So she's checking that these are not Hezbollah people?
She's checking, yes.
Why is that? Is she worried?
Yes, because if there is any family from Hezbollah, maybe they will come to their family.
They've left their homes behind because of the fighting. Did they bring anything with them? Did they just leave everything?
No one. Just they come with one clothes and they say they will buy second a few days later. All they come in 1 or 2 cars maximum, you know, and just the people inside the car and some small food. And, you know, there is people, they have the period and they can't change the pads for them.
What is the mood of the people like? How worried are they?
Tired. Just tired. Just they need house to go and sleep and to take rest, because the kids, they make them crazy in the car.
What do they tell you about Hezbollah?
The people, they come from the south, from the border, they still supported Hezbollah.
Do they think they will win? That Hezbollah will beat Israel?
Yes, and also they are saying about if they cross the border by tank and like that, Israel will be in trouble. This is what they believe. I don't know.
Fadi speaking from Hamana in Lebanon. Well, others who fled the bombing are crowding into shelters with no idea how long they'll be there. Dr. Tania Banan is country director of the medical charity Med Global Lebanon. What are the biggest challenges that they're facing right now?
There are many, actually, James. We started by implementing an emergency response, first of all, for the displaced people who were flooding in on Monday after the escalation of the attacks in the south. And after doing a mapping yesterday, we realized that the numbers were quite large. We have in one school facility more than 10,000 people. So one of the first hurdles is actually finding the suppliers as soon as possible to be able to procure these displaced people's basic needs. And the prices are rising as we speak. And the second hurdle was that we were able to get international aid through donors, and those were being shipped to us, and we were supposed to receive them in a few days. But as of yesterday, it was announced that all commercial carriers will not be flying into Lebanon. So that aid now has stopped, and we're trying to find alternative solutions to bring it in. The last and third hurdle is to obviously support the immense stress that the Ministry of Health is getting. We're being flooded with injured patients, and, you know, patients who are already sick with chronic illnesses. The hospitals are very overwhelmed, especially after last week's attack, when we had almost simultaneously 3,000 people dispatched by ambulances to be received in university hospitals in the capital within an hour. So you can imagine all of this in the past week. In addition, add to that, the crisis that Lebanon has been going through since 2019, and this war that's been going on for 11 months. So it's really, really reaching a brink, and we're worried that the healthcare system will completely collapse.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, is it really struggling to cope at the moment?
It is. In last week's attack, patients had to be transferred to go to multiple hospitals to see different specialists because it's very difficult to find multiple specialists under the same roof.
And is that because of the complex nature of the injuries?
Exactly. The injuries were quite identical as well. So imagine having 3,000 patients with identical injuries. You're having eye injuries, face injuries, neck injuries, and hand injuries. So now you've narrowed that to ophthalmology, ENT, and orthopedic specialists with hand experience or microscopic hand subspecialists. So we don't have a lot of subspecialists in the country. So the frontline doctors had been working really nonstop.
In terms of those who've fled the bombardment, mainly in the south, what are their needs in the immediate term?
The most immediate needs right now, because some people had to leave without anything. They left everything behind. So we're talking about clothing, winter is on our doorstep, but also daily food meals that are already prepared because there are no kitchens for them to even cook if you want to provide them with dry food for them to prepare, but also mattresses, pillows, personal hygiene kits. So we're starting with those, and we haven't even thought about the patients who left their medications behind. You know, you have elderly patients who are diabetic, hypertensive, anyone with chronic diseases who need their chronic medication. And that's without saying there are also patients who need dialysis and patients who need chemotherapy.
And if you can't get the stuff you need on commercial flights, what routes are available to you then?
So right now, we still have supplies in the country, but the other route would be through Syria. Now, we have the experience from 2006 when the airport was hit and it was closed down. That route through the border, the Syrian borders, was still open. This time, it's a different scenario because it's not that easy to go through Jordan and have that kind of shipment coming through Syria under the circumstances.
Just finally, are you imagining that this is going to go on just for a few days, or are you planning for weeks and months?
We're planning up to the end of the year. So all our plans of distributions, we're budgeting till end of December. And hopefully that will be the end of it.
Dr. Tania Banan of the Charity Med Global Lebanon. More on this story coming up in about 15 minutes. You're listening to NewsHour. Also still to come, Cuba once prided itself on exceptionally low rates of crime. But has that now become a thing of the past?
So many young people have been killed this year. The violence is getting out of hand. They are basically gangs. They fall out with each other as gangs. And that's where it's all coming from, the killings and the deaths of young people.
More from Cuba coming up in 20 minutes. Our main headlines from the BBC newsroom this hour. Israel's latest barrage of strikes targeting Hezbollah in Lebanon has killed more than 20 people and injured scores more. And the charity MSF says that pregnant women, mothers and newborns are dying in Sudan's South Darfur region, where the health system, it says, has now collapsed. This is James Fernandez with NewsHour live from the BBC. Now, children's eyesight appears to be getting worse. That's according to a new study published in the British Journal of Ophthalmology, which also shows that one in three children worldwide is now short-sighted. And that number is likely to continue rising in the years ahead. Well, we can speak now to Denise Voon, who's clinical advisor to the College of Optometrists here in the UK. Denise, welcome to the programme. First of all, your reaction to the study.
Well, thank you very much for having me on, firstly. But yes, the study is alarming, but not surprising. I think anecdotally, our members and our optometrists have been noticing that there has been a shift and a trend towards more children becoming short-sighted.
And what do they put that down to in their anecdotal evidence, first of all?
So we're never really 100% sure what causes somebody to become myopic or not. We know that it is likely that people, or more likely for people with East Asian origins, to develop myopia. But also we know that spending time outside can certainly reduce the rate of developing myopia. So what we think is perhaps likely to have happened, certainly we've seen it during COVID, is when children have been spending more time indoors and at home when they've been confined to the indoors, children seem to have developed short-sightedness at an earlier age.
It sounds like your dog wants to spend more time outside. I mean, there is a huge difference geographically, isn't it? That the numbers, as you say, in East Asia compared to those in, for example, I think Uganda in Africa. I mean, it's quite marked, isn't it?
Absolutely. And again, this could be due to genetics. So it could be because those in Japan and South Korea, that their ethnicity lends them towards developing myopia. But also it is likely that those in those countries, they're spending more time indoors, more time in their flats rather than outside.
Why does being outside help? I mean, is it simply that the children are then looking at things further in the distance and that helps the eye muscles? Is it that?
So we don't know 100% for sure, but we think that could be one of the factors, along with spending time in natural daylight. That could be another factor, or just doing more exercise when they're being outdoors.
And are there more dangers to children? I mean, obviously, you know, some people might say, well, look, it's fine. We can give children glasses and correct that. But it's more than that, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, short-sightedness, so rarely, but it can happen. If you're very short-sighted, you can be more at risk of certain conditions such as retinal detachment, which is potentially sight-threatening. I mean, as I said, it is very rare, but there is a risk that the more people who are myopic, then the chances are that more people might be prone to these sorts of conditions.
Yeah, so more time outside, less time on screens. I mean, I think that's advice that everyone can subscribe to. Denise, thank you very much indeed. Denise Voon, clinical advisor to the UK College of Optometrists. Just let me tell you that there is a live page on our top story today, the continuing attacks, the bombardment by Israel of parts of Lebanon. It's up and running at the moment. The latest that Israel has says that it's struck 60 Hezbollah targets. This is according to the Israeli military, including Hezbollah's intelligence division. 60 Hezbollah targets in the latest bombardment today. There's also figures from the Lebanese government about how many people have been killed in those Israeli strikes today. 23 people killed and many more have been injured. BBC.com/news. As I say, we will be returning to the story. We're going to be hearing where Iran stands on all this. Iran, of course, Hezbollah's sponsor. That's coming up in about 5 minutes' time. You're listening to NewsApp for the BBC World Service.
I'm Gabriel Gatehouse, and from BBC Radio 4, this is Series 2 of The Coming Storm. There's a divide in American politics between those who think democracy is in peril and those who think it's already been subverted, hollowed out from the inside. As America prepares to elect its next president, we go through the looking glass into a world where nothing is as it seems, and the institutions of the state are a facade. Listen wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
You're listening to News Hour. Now, floods which devastated Central Europe earlier this month were made much worse by climate change, according to a new study by a group called the World Weather Attribution Group. At least 24 people were killed and billions of dollars of damage was done in countries such as Poland, the Czech Republic, Austria and Italy. Liz Stevens is Professor of Climate Risks and Resilience at Reading University here in the UK. She was involved in this study. So how could they be sure the floods were caused by climate change?
So there has been a rapid attribution study, and that study is telling us that these kinds of heavy rainfall events have become twice as likely as a result of the 1.3 degrees of warming that have already been experienced as a result of climate change. And the study is also saying that these events will become twice as likely again if we get to the 2 degrees of warming, which was the goal of the Paris Agreement.
But can you say that this particular event was definitely as a result of climate change, or was it just perhaps an aberration?
We're confident that climate change is having a really strong role in influencing the frequency and the severity of these kinds of events.
To what extent were countries better prepared to deal with these floods? And is that the answer?
So Central Europe has experienced floods perhaps lesser in extent than before, but certainly there are fewer fatalities this time than the floods from previous years in 1997 and 2002. But what we can't see is the huge costs that have been incurred since 2002 to manage the flood risk in these countries.
And they were huge, the costs this time round, weren't they?
Absolutely. And we won't really know the true economic impact for some time, because, of course, the widespread disruption from these floods is going to be enormous as well. But we do know that the EU have already provided 10 billion euros in immediate support to the countries affected. And that's an incredibly large amount of money.
And there will, of course, be a huge personal cost to many families affected, those whose homes have been flooded. Is that making people understand what the true costs of climate change are and changing, therefore, policy on climate change, do you think?
I think what we know is that unless people are personally affected by flooding and really experience that very long-term impact, and in many cases, people will be out of their homes for, you know, maybe even up to a year or more. And unless people experience that, then it's not easy to understand the costs of this kind of event on sort of an individual as a taxpayer. But this enormous amount of money that's being released by the EU, the enormous costs that have been incurred to manage the flood risk in these countries, ultimately that is being borne by the taxpayer.
Is it at that point that it feeds into policy, where governments say, look, actually, we can't keep paying for this stuff. We have to find another way.
Absolutely. And there are costs incurred with mitigating climate change, but also with dealing with the impacts of climate change. And so politicians who are perhaps not in favour of mitigating it and not meeting the goals of the Paris Agreement, they need to be asking themselves whether they are willing to incur these high costs.
Liz Stevens, Professor of Climate Risks and Resilience at Reading University here in the UK. This is the BBC in London. You're listening to NewsHour. I'm James Menendez. Let's return to our top story now. And the escalation in the conflict between Israel and the Lebanese militia group Hezbollah. It is Iran's most powerful ally in the region, far bigger and far better armed than Hamas ever was. But what sort of response does Iran want or expect from Hezbollah to Israel's extensive bombardment of its stronghold in southern Lebanon? Indeed, how much control does it have? Well, Iran's new president, Masoud Pezeshkian, has made his first address to the annual gathering of world leaders at the UN General Assembly. He used his speech to accuse Israel of fanning the flames of war in the Middle East and to condemn what he called Israeli crimes against humanity in Gaza and state terrorism in Lebanon, as he put it. He also said his country was ready to end its nuclear standoff with the West.
Iran amadegi darad.
In order to build a better future world, Iran stands prepared to foster meaningful economic, social, political, and security partnerships with global powers and its neighbors based on equal footing. The appropriate response to this message from Iran is not to impose more sanctions, but to fulfill existing obligations to remove sanctions, benefiting the Iranian people, and hence laying the foundations for more constructive agreements.
Let's talk to Dr. Sanam Vakil, Director of the Middle East and North Africa Programme at the Foreign Affairs Think Tank Chatham House. Very good to have you with us as ever. Constructive agreements, those words at the end there. I mean, is Iran looking to build bridges then rather than destroy them with a bigger response from its ally Hezbollah, do you think?
Thanks for having me on. And I would say that Iran is trying to keep the door or open the door for negotiations. It hasn't been able to have serious negotiations with Europe and the United States for quite some time. Currently, there's a sort of mini arrangement with Washington. But the current president is seeking broader sanctions relief to alleviate the economic pain and pressure back in Iran. So that is one objective. Simultaneously, though, the Axis of Resistance, which is a network of relationships that Iran has cultivated across the region, including with Hezbollah, is very important to Iran's defense posture and its security in the region. And so Iran wants to see the Axis of Resistance survive this conflict right now underway, but also the war in Gaza. And so it's playing a strategic and longer game. It sees Israel trying to degrade the access, to push back the access, to create buffer zones, if you will. But it's hoping that this isn't going to end in a broader war.
Yeah, I mean, are both those objectives compatible, do you think?
Well, of course, it depends how things play out in the next few days. Israel is certainly taking this moment to degrade Hezbollah's capabilities as much as it can. It's being given a lot of latitude and leeway. And of course, the impact is quite devastating on Hezbollah, but it's being borne primarily by the Lebanese people. The high loss of life, huge civilian casualties and displacement is spreading across Lebanon. And I think Israel is also trying to goad Hezbollah into responding and provoking Israel to mobilize ground troops, if not, of course, to enter into Lebanese territory.
Is Tehran worried that Hezbollah does look severely weakened at the moment with the loss of senior commanders and the fact that Israel was able to carry out those pager attacks?
Certainly. Of course, Iran is worried. I think, though, we should remember that the Israel-Hezbollah confrontation is the conflict that both countries, both Hezbollah and Israel, have been preparing for, anticipating since the last major conflict in 2006. Israel clearly has intelligence and military dominance over Hezbollah. It has really, the Israelis have taken out key commanders, but also destabilize the operations of the group. And that is very troubling. But you know what? Week by week, this conflict in the region, which, is looking like a war, we're just not calling it that, changes and the optics change. Iran is a strategic longer-term actor, and I think it is not worried about the moment as much as it is trying to prevent that broader regional war. And it thinks that over time it can, bolster Hezbollah and keep Hezbollah alive. Ultimately, Hezbollah and Iran are aligned now for many decades. They have deep relationships, and the idea of resistance can't, completely be eradicated through this campaign. So that's what they're going to bank on.
Yeah, and you say aligned. I just wonder, how much control over Hezbollah does Iran actually have? In other words, if Hezbollah said, look, we're going to have to respond with a massive barrage of missiles, and Iran says, we don't want you to do that, would Hezbollah listen?
Well, I think, that's the $10 billion question. From my research and analysis, I think that there is less command and control. Hezbollah is much more of a partner of Iran rather than a proxy. And since the death of Qasem Soleimani, the Iranian IRGC commander who was killed by the U.S. in 2020, that partnership has grown. Iran relies much more on Hezbollah to coordinate, and it has always given Hezbollah independence to operate within its own landscape. And that's why the relationship continues to survive. They trust each other's judgments, and they know that they will come out of this one way or another, battered and bruised, but they will come out of it.
Sanam, thank you very much indeed. Dr. Sanam Vakil, Director of the Middle East Programme at Chatham House, the foreign affairs think tank based here in London. Fidel Castro famously called Cuba the safest country in the world. And when it came to the communist-run island's low rates of violent crime, he may have had a legitimate claim to that title. However, in recent months, crime seems to have got worse in Cuba. Official government crime statistics remain low. However, many believe they fail to reflect the reality on the streets. More and more victims have reported their experiences on social media, from muggings at knife point to burglary and even gang-related violence. And adding to the problem is the popularity of a cheap new drug in Cuba, as Will Grant reports from Havana.
In the low-income Havana neighbourhood of Cayo Hueso, friends of an aspiring music producer called Ian Franco gathered to send him off in song. Just 19 years old when he was killed, Jan was stabbed twice in the chest following a disagreement outside a recording studio, caught in the middle when one of the youths pulled a knife. Another tragic killing on the traditionally safe Caribbean island. A month on, his older sister Samantha remains in a state of numb grief. As she scrolls through photos of Jan Franco on her computer, she says her brother's murder has torn a hole in her family. Yet Jan Franco is just one of many to have been killed in recent months over trivial arguments and gang rivalries, says Samantha.
So many young people have been killed this year. The violence is getting out of hand. They are basically gangs. They fall out with each other as gangs. And that's where it's all coming from, the killings and the deaths of young people.
Do these gangs often solve their quarrels with knives and machetes, I asked her.
Yes, almost no one settles an argument with their fists anymore. It's all knives, machetes, even guns. Things I just don't understand.
Samantha adds that a new drug called Químico, a cheap chemical high with a cannabis base, is increasingly popular among Cuban youth in the parks and on the streets. Previously, just saying that Cuba has a problem with street drugs and violent crime, especially to a foreign journalist, could land you in trouble. The authorities in Havana have always played down the social problems on the island and been quick to paint any criticism of their communist system as anti-revolutionary lies originating from Miami or Washington. But such has been the perception of a sharp drop in public security that top government officials had to acknowledge the problem on state TV, including a discussion of the drug Químico. On air, the government claimed just 9% of crimes in Cuba are violent and just 3% are murders. However, there is a serious lack of transparency over government crime statistics. In large part, the Cuban state continues to blame the old enemy, the United States, for both the presence of opioids on the island and for the U.S. embargo, which they argue has made economic life in Cuba so dire that some are turning to crime.
And so the difficulty facing the authorities in Cuba is that a low crime rate has traditionally been one of the revolution's standout achievements. When critics pointed to the lack of rights on the island, they would retort that the streets of Havana were safer than almost any in the United States. So if that's now beginning to slip, people will increasingly ask what exactly they're getting in return for their lack of basic freedoms.
El robo con violencia en esa escala de delitos penales es menor.
In a rare interview, the vice president of Cuba's Supreme Court, Marisela Sosa, insisted to the BBC that only a tiny fraction of crimes committed involved violence and were being blown out of proportion on social media. And she refuted the suggestion that many crimes go unreported through a lack of confidence in the police.
In my 30 years as a judge and magistrate, I don't think that the Cuban people lack confidence in their authorities, because in Cuba, the police have a high success rate in solving crimes. Problems are resolved, and we don't see people taking the law into their own hands, which happens in other parts of Latin America and elsewhere, which suggests people trust in the Cuban justice system.
Most people in Cuba, it seems, have either recently been a victim of opportunistic theft themselves or have a friend, neighbour or relative who has been. Many remain wary of talking publicly, But Shaida Gonzalez, a transgender activist in Cuba, is used to speaking out and says her story of being robbed at knife point of all her personal effects one night on Havana's dark streets is now common. It was the response by the police which disillusioned her the most, she adds.
After the attack, I came across two motorbike police officers in a nearby street. I was very distressed and said to them, look what just happened to me. But they directly told me, we're not here for stuff like that. It was such an awful thing to hear because I told them where they could find the attacker, showed them which direction he was headed in, what he was wearing, but they just didn't pay any attention to me.
In contrast to their raucous singing, when the moment came to load Jan Franco onto the hearse, his friends shouldered his coffin in hushed tones and tearful murmurings. Cuba's youth face more difficulties growing up than most in the Caribbean, and many have fled in search of greater opportunities. Those that stay must now contend with rising crime too, as another pillar of the Cuban Revolution, public safety, now looks more unstable than at any other time since the Cold War.
And that was Will Grant reporting there from Havana. You're listening to NewsHour. This is James Menendez with NewsHour. Let's head to the far north of India now, right up into the Himalayas in the region of Kashmir. In other words, the part of Kashmir that's administered by India. The region's also claimed by Pakistan, and it's been the cause of three wars between these two nuclear-armed neighbours. It's also seen a long-running armed insurgency against Indian rule. So, a sensitive part of the world to say the least, and even more tense since the Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi scrapped Muslim-majority Kashmir's semi-autonomous status. That was in 2019. Today, though, elections are taking place to choose a new local assembly. This is the second of three voting phases. Let's speak to the BBC's Arunoday Mukherjee, who joins us from Kashmir's largest city, Srinagar. Very good to have you with us on the line from Srinagar. So, I mean, is this about restoring Kashmir's partial autonomy, or is it something short of that?
Well, thanks for having me, James. Well, you know, for starters, it's very important to say that that aspect that you mentioned, the fact that the autonomy that this region had enjoyed for decades, which was taken away by the Indian government in 2019, continues to be one of the most emotive issues here as we speak to voters. And we've been speaking to them over the last 1 week. And that's what they tell us. That's what resonates the most. And that's really been central to these elections. In fact, we asked a lot of them, are they hopeful that, you know, that's something that could perhaps be reversed, but a lot of people are resigned to the fact that that's something that is very unlikely to happen. But what they do tell us is that by way of using the ballot, they are able to convey a message to the larger leadership. They are finally feeling empowered after a very long time that they have a say, and that's why you're seeing people coming out in larger numbers to vote in these elections. In fact, we've been driving across polling booths all day, and even early in the morning we saw people queuing up, something that was not very common in the past elections when we've seen you know, boycotts and elections being marred by violence. But this time a lot of people tell us that it's very important that they send out a message through the ballot, you know, and also try and get a local assembly in place which will be their voice and a buffer, in a sense, between the people of Indian-administered Kashmir and the central leadership in Delhi.
And does that include separatists? Because as I understand it, they were among those who boycotted these kinds of votes in the past, but not this time, right?
So that's a very interesting point you mentioned, because a lot of separatist organizations that are considered to be separatist organizations, some of the organizations like, say, Jamaat-e-Islami, which has been banned by the Indian government, they are interestingly supporting candidates who are standing at an independent status. So these are independent candidates, but they are backed by these groups. They are also participating in the election process. And I spoke to one of them just outside Srinagar, about 2 hours outside Srinagar in the city of Kulgam. And I asked him these questions what's the reason behind coming in and participating in the electoral process? And he told me something very interesting. He said, it's now time that we need to come inside the system to change the system. And for that, we need to participate in these elections. So that's certainly signaling some sort of a change here in the valley. Now, the other side of the story, James, is that the ruling government in Delhi, that is led by the Bharatiya Janata Party, Prime Minister Modi's party, is citing the involvement and the participation of these elements, the higher voter turnout, as big wins for their government since they brought this region under its direct rule in New Delhi. They're saying, look, we should be credited for bringing peace to the region. Earlier on, separatist sources would be boycotting elections, but now they're participating. So that's something that should be seen as a victory, as a sign of development, as a sign of progress in bringing these elements into the mainstream. Now, the other argument that the BJP gives is that, look, we bought peace, we bought development. But a lot of people who I spoke to over here, they say that, look, promises are one thing. We're yet to see those benefits here in the valley.
Yeah. Arunade, thank you very much indeed. That was the BBC's Arunade Mukherjee joining us live from Srinagar, Kashmir's largest city. Now, assisted suicide may be legal in Switzerland, but on Tuesday, several people were arrested there after a woman was allowed to die using what's become known as a suicide pod. The Swiss government says the capsules aren't compatible with the laws on assisted suicide. We can speak to the BBC's correspondent in Switzerland, Imogen Folks. Imogen, why aren't they compatible? What's the problem with these capsules?
Two specific legal things. I should add, this is the very first time ever this capsule has been used. Specifically, it hasn't, the health minister said, passed Swiss safety regulations, which all devices have to go through. And the other is that it uses gas inside this capsule, and that this is not compliant, compatible with Switzerland's laws on the use of chemicals. So those are the two specific legal clauses. I think the other more broadly is that normally with assisted suicide in Switzerland, which has been legal under certain conditions since the 1940s, medical assessment and supervision is normally required. And that's also seen as a guardrail against the healthy but desperate and suicidal, perhaps depressed, that there can be medical support for them. And this appears not to have been the case. And this is one of the reasons there has been such concern about it.
So what's going to happen to those who've been arrested then? I mean, are they going to be charged and what? They'll go to court?
I think the court case is the key thing. I think we should remember that several regions, cantons in Switzerland, and they have the responsibility for health, said when this pod was unveiled in July, don't even think about bringing it into our region because we will launch criminal proceedings. Now, the people who are, you know, proposing this device took it to specifically one of those cantons. So I think they actually probably want this test case, and we're going to have a very probably a long assessment of what is legal and what is permitted under the existing Swiss assisted suicide law. But what I would say here in Switzerland is that most people here hate the idea of what's become known as suicide tourism. The people who invented this device are not Swiss, and they brought it across the border. The people who were arrested, and a number of them, are also not Swiss. And the Swiss themselves hate this. They actually think, okay, we have our law. We do believe in an individual's right to choose the moment of death, but other countries should sort this out themselves and not use us as this kind of place where they can, you know, abdicate their own responsibility for what in many countries large sections of the population say they would also like to have this individual choice.
Very interesting. Imogen, thank you very much indeed. That was Imogen Folks, the BBC's correspondent in Switzerland. And that brings us to the end of this edition of News Hour. Thanks so much for being with us. I'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Until then, bye-bye.
I'm Gabriel Gatehouse, and from BBC Radio 4, this is Series 2 of The Coming Storm. There's a divide in American politics between those who think democracy is in peril and those who think it's already been subverted, hollowed out from the inside. As America prepares to elect its next president, we go through the looking glass into a world where nothing is as it seems, and the institutions of the state are a facade. Listen wherever you get your BBC podcasts.